This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Future Earth may be home to grass, bugs, and maybe, maybe a few humans. It's a hot radioactive world we're talking about, a time our next guest calls the Plutocene. And that doesn't come from a sci-fi writer or a conspiracy blogger. We will be talking about the new book by a preeminent Australian scientist, Dr. Andrew Glickson. Andrew is an Earth and paleoclimate scientist. He's currently a visiting fellow at Australian National University. He was educated in Australia. He traveled extensively into the outback, investigating those signs kept in some of the Earth's oldest rocks. He knows the science of climate, geology, asteroids, volcanoes, and nuclear radiation. And all of that comes together in his new book, The Plutocene, Blueprints for a Post-Anthropocene Greenhouse Earth. It is published by Springer, the serious textbook in science, people. So, Andrew, you and I have been in email contact since at least 2008 when I ran your speech at Australia National University. It's great to talk to you in person, despite the news about the planet. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you very much for interviewing me.
And you were just telling me that you tried to send a letter and get something published and nobody wants to talk about it. Tell us about that.
Well, I organized an open letter to the Australian Prime Minister. It was signed by 200 scientists, which is not more than 10% of the number of scientists who received this letter, so it comes to show scientific reticence, which James Hansen talks about nowadays quite a lot. Scientific reticence, only about 10% of scientists in relevant fields have signed it, but still, there were 200. And once the letter was signed, I sent it to the Prime Minister. Haven't got a reply yet, but normally they reply after several weeks and give us some formal reply. But the interesting part was that no mainstream media channel, not the radio, the ABC, not anyone wanted to publish this letter, even though it's written very politely, I believe, and points out to some of the main facts, the evidence. This, to me, it's a litmus test. It's a litmus test in terms of the response of the public and the scientific public and the media, which is, of course, critical, so critical, to what is going on. There's still many programs on the television and so on about what is happening in terms of the hurricanes in the Caribbean, so in Southwest Pacific, in terms of mega fires in California and Europe, but the explanation that these extreme weather events are related to global warming, which is a direct consequence of carbon emission, human carbon emission, this is very, very, very quiet. So the public is not, many in the public are not in a very good position to understand the connection between these catastrophes and between emissions.
It is a great silence, and it surprises me a bit. I thought, and many climate activists thought, that once the world turned stormy and dangerous, that people would want to hear about it, but not yet, apparently.
Not yet, apparently. And there is, of course, as you know, a huge lie industry, which is on websites and everywhere, which is trying to say that, oh, whatever happens is just natural and so on, including language which we don't want to repeat, insults. But very recently, I've been looking at reading very interesting speeches and interviews, particularly with James Hansen, who, you know, estimates that to draw down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is really the only effective way to cool the Earth. He estimated it at about 600 billion per year, but this is less than 50%, in fact, it's a third of the global military budget, annual budget, which means that, in fact, humanity has a choice now. If this carbon dioxide drawdown works, and it is known in principle to work, even if perhaps not on the required scale, then humanity has a choice. either to keep on bombing people in remote parts of the earth, preparing a nuclear war, updating their already horrible nuclear arsenals, basically being bent on death. Humanity has a choice of either spending, what is it now, $1.6 trillion per year on preparation for world genocide, ecocide, or direct resources on a similar scale towards saving the biosphere.
I'd like to get to your book here. I know you're a paleoclimatologist, you're an earth scientist, and we will get to the existential threats of climate change. I'd like to leave that towards our second segment. You've mentioned the military just now, and I want to ask you, why did you begin your new book with our outlook for nuclear catastrophe?
The new book, the two are related to the biocide. The two are related in terms of the consequences, but the two involve different processes, of course. Climate change, global warming has started now for, well, started to accelerate in series after World War II. The nuclear event can happen any moment. So one is somewhat gradual, even though it's accelerating and it's now a runaway climate change, but the other one is a press of a button. So why did I include it? Well, I've been with scientists against nuclear arms for about 7 or 8 years in the 1980s, so I was acquainted with the problem. And then through the science, I've obviously became very aware of climate change. But to me, it's the consequences which are the issue, and the consequences of both are, as you know, they are what the term horrendous. So yes, I did combine them.
It's an important marriage. It's something that I do on this show, and I have been criticized by some listeners about my coverage of nuclear affairs, and particularly of Fukushima, who say, well, you know, Alex, I like your climate stuff, but this nuclear thing, I don't know why you bother with it. And I think that you and I agree that it is definitely worth bothering about. Now, I want to read one short quote from your book from Chapter 1. You say that our addiction to war, quote, guarantees dissemination of radioactive nuclides on land, oceans, and atmosphere, heralding the Pleistocene, a geological era due to persist for tens of thousands of years, as recorded by the buildup of plutonium-rich clay layers in ocean sediments, end quote. And I began scribbling notes that nobody can guarantee the future, and maybe a nuclear war will never happen. But then you present the case, well, this whole nuclear debacle has already started since 1945, and even without a war, we're polluting the earth with nuclear affairs. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, as a geologist by training, the signature for in future geological eras or for future intelligent being of what is happening now will be this layer of rich in plutonium in the oceans. That's a geological marker. Now, the probability, and I mean, I always hope I'm wrong in what I'm saying about whether it's the nuclear or the climate. I always hope I'm wrong, but I think the evidence is there. The probabilities are that if you have nuclear missile fleets, there are some, I think, 15,000 now, and they are developing new ones all the time. And the probability is that if nuclear reactors, our plants continue to operate and new ones are being built, the probabilities are that radioactive nucleids will be disseminated through the atmosphere, through water and in the soils because of human errors, because of natural disasters such as the earthquake, tsunami at Fukushima, human errors in Chernobyl. I think the probabilities are inevitable. The only way to avert it is to dismantle these doomsday machines. It is related to climate because even though it's a different rate, different processes, the consequences are not different. In a way, they're quite the same, which means, well, the demise of much of the biosphere. I don't think in terms of the demise of the Earth because having studied the great mass extinctions, the Earth always comes back. The biosphere always comes back in a new cycle, in a new form.
I want to talk about the war that we have kind of declared by the nuclear testing that was done. And it's painful to see the maps and descriptions of those tests in your book. And it wasn't enough to blow up parts of our own countries like the United States, the Soviet Union, France, and Britain. We had to irradiate other people's lands. Tell us about some of the places where testing took place and who got those cancers.
Yes, indeed. It was through this horrible testing of weapons which could never be used, or they were finished with us all. The hydrogen bomb was the Russian one in Novozemlya.
Oh, I think that one was 57 megatons, La Bomba, or the Bomba, the big one.
That's right, Tsar Bomba, the biggest one ever exploded in Novozemlya. And the consequence of migration and death of them, because the death is gradual, not always immediate, of the Inuits and of herds of caribou and so on, then was the same in Kazakhstan, and then in China, in the Gobi Desert, where there are no accurate numbers, but there are claims that hundreds of thousands of people became very ill. Of course, as you know, in the Marshall Islands and Polynesia, in the Sahara, and some in South Africa. And so the list goes on and on and on. Now, all of this releases plutonium. All the plutonium is accumulated not only in the oceans, but in soils. This is gradual, but it's very interesting that actually much of nature, plants and animals, for example, around Chernobyl, they survive. They don't show much evidence of what happens. So that's why the promoters of nuclear energy can say, oh, nature comes back, kind of thing. But in the long term, cancer increases, and cancer rates increase, and the biosphere, well, the biosphere exists because thanks to the atmosphere and the ozone layer and the ionosphere being a shelter, or offering a shelter from cosmic radiation. So the results in the long term, well, first you get the nuclear winter due to the aerosols. This in itself will be extremely destructive to agriculture and to life. In the long term, the release of nuclear war releases, of course, also a lot of carbon dioxide from the bombed areas and from the fires. The whole thing belongs to the unthinkable. It belongs to the unthinkable, and therefore, in the book, I cite some of the evidence for what's already happened, the wars against the indigenous people, which is in itself a crime against humanity, this test. Crimes against humanity, crimes against the earth, is a term which comes to mind. In World War II, they had to wait until after the war in the Nuremberg trials. As you know, of course, here, are there going to be any trials in advance of what is happening now, like trials of crimes against the earth? I don't know any lawyers who are interested in doing that. I'm only an individual paleoclimate and earth scientist, but I find that the venue is a platform for communication of the evidence of what is happening now have been disappearing and disappearing over a number of years.
That's so true. You know, I found in your book in a couple of tables this amazing fact that Americans on average get more radiation than most other humans. In fact, the average dose for an American is twice the world average. I'm wondering why that is. Is it because of the 100 or so reactors that are in the United States, or all the testing that was done there, or all of that?
Yeah, all of that. There is a map in the book which shows radiation levels in the United States are quite high, but then radiation levels in Europe are also high after Chernobyl, and the same goes in Japan. In the United States, well, there have been, of course, tests in the Nevada desert, and some of the radiation from the Marshall Islands and the Polynesia has drifted to the Pacific. It all accumulates, but it's uneven. You get hot spots and so on, the way the winds blow. You know the song, Where the Winds Blow?
Yeah. Well, you've also written about a nuclear winter, which is expected to follow the use of nuclear weapons on a major city or cities. I'm wondering, is the science behind that really solid, Andrew?
Well, I think it is. You see, it's in part based on the analysis of the atmospheric conditions as a consequence of the dinosaur event, the asteroid that hit Yucatan some 66 million years ago. The consequences were studied, modeled rather, and by Carl Sagan and Terko and other people. Now, if a city burns, bombed and burns, there is so much carbon, so much soot and carbon concentrated in any big city or even some smaller city. This goes up, which means you get aerosols on a vast scale, which again start to move with the wind. The atmospheric residence time of aerosols is, of course, a lot shorter. And carbon dioxide can stay in the atmosphere for thousands to tens of thousands of years. Aerosols stay on the level of time scale of weeks to months. But yes, this will result in perhaps more regional than global nuclear winter, which will retard plant growth and so on. My reading of it is that it is solid science.
I can't decide if I'm more objectionable drunk or sober.
It's perfectly all right. We were at sea between Kiska and Midway when it began. We got orders to go to the West Pacific. And when we put our nose up north of Iwo Jima, the air was filled with radioactive dust. So, we ducked. Later on, took a look at Manila through the periscope. Still too hot to surface, so we came on down the coast of Australia and ended up here. Not much of any place else to go.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Andrew Glickson from Australia, and we're talking about his new book about the Pleistocene. Andrew, you've said that arthropods, a collection that includes insects, spiders, and some crustaceans, will be the likely survivors. Do you want to explain that a bit?
Yes, well, insects, and especially certain cockroaches, beetles, ants, and so on, they have extreme resistance to radiation. They have been, it has been tested in laboratories. They can stand radiation virtually order of magnitude higher than mammals. And they also live much of the time, or most of the time, underground, extremely intelligent survivor communities or colonies. They are very lucky to survive. Plants will survive, or many plants will survive. There are plants with different resistance to radiation. And other animals which live underground in areas remote or distant from explosion, nuclear explosions. So it's not a question that the biosphere will be destroyed. It will result in a hiatus. Again, not unsimilar to the hiatus following the KT asteroid event. We learned a lot from that. But there will be vacant niches, ecological niches, into which the arthropods will expand very rapidly. There will be enough vegetation matter for them to eat. The nuclear winter, regional nuclear winters, should not worry them too much, I don't think. Carbon dioxide heating, well, they can take high temperatures too. So now to humans, it's very different, of course. There will need to be, there will have to be, and I think there will, I imagine there will be shelters such as, for example, a human body cannot stand temperatures above a certain level. But in the subarctic, like parts of Canada and Siberia, temperatures will still be within a range tolerable to the human body. The question is whether they can find food. So, well, they might have to go back to hunting and gathering because agriculture will be much more difficult here because of the nuclear winter, because of fires on a warmer earth. But humans have displayed enormous capacity to survive, huge capacity to survive over the last, well, at least 2 million years. a period during which there have been catastrophes of every kind, whether it's climatic, whether it's volcanic, and also extreme events as well. Yet, even though they were pushed almost to the limit, humans have survived. So to me, it is a species which is just as likely to have survivors in certain parts of the world. As to civilization, no, I don't believe that it can have a future under 4 degrees Celsius. It's hard to imagine. That's what Joachim Schellenhuber, the German chief climate scientist, when he was asked what does 4 degrees mean, he said civilization. As for one thing, extreme weather events will affect industrial centers. Sea level rise will inundate some of the world's major urban areas, and as well as lower river valleys, where you get much of the agriculture, much of the population. It goes on and on and on. It's devastating. It does belong to the unthinkable. And I always hope, when I talk to the public, that I'm wrong. I just hope I'm plain wrong.
Before we talk more about the climate disaster, I want to get to one last scary thought from your new book, and that is, you think it's possible that if a nuclear war breaks out, the survivors may never know what happened. I mean, that's why? That's a frightening thought, I think.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure you might have seen this film about Melbourne, life in Melbourne following a nuclear war.
Was that the beach?
It's Melbourne is, well, disconnected from the world, and all that happens is that, there is actually an American submarine which turns up there, but gradually over a period of weeks, the level of radioactivity rises up. On the beach.
On the beach, that's the one, yeah.
Why is it taking so long? Can you explain it to me? Nobody can explain it to me. And don't tell me about all those damn winds again. Of the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere get all mixed up and overlapping. I don't want to hear about that anymore. All I want to know is, if everybody was so smart, why didn't they know what would happen?
They did.
Well, I can't take it. Oh, yes, I can take it. But it's unfair. It's unfair because I didn't do anything. And nobody I know did anything.
Okay, now let's get to climate change. Now, here's one thing you make clear, and that is, even if there is a nuclear war and a period of cooling in a nuclear winter, the world will go right back to warming itself into a new hot age. You seem pretty sure about that.
Well, carbon dioxide is the factor. The sun, as you know, is oscillating along the 11-year sunspot cycle and is relatively uniform, changing only by a fraction of a watt per square meter. But the carbon dioxide is now climbing above 400 parts per million, and if you include methane and nitric oxide, we are around 450. That's the level at which the ice sheets become unstable, and they are becoming unstable. So the nuclear winter, the time scale is very different. Nuclear winter, they were saying, it's a question of weeks to months. But the aerosols don't stay long in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is thousands to tens of thousands of years in terms of longevity in the atmosphere.
You know, you mentioned James Hansen, and I want to read you one quote that you had in your book from James Hansen, namely, these predictions, especially the cooling in the Southern Ocean and Northern Atlantic, with markedly reduced warming or even cooling in Europe, differ fundamentally from existing climate change assessments. What's your opinion on James Hansen's work and his role now?
I have a very high opinion of his work, but now you're talking about the studios. It's very interesting because relatively few people are aware of it. It's already starting to happen. So studios occur when the ice sheets warm to the extent that large volumes of cold water, cold ice water, flow from the glaciers harder to the North Atlantic and to some extent also around the Antarctic. And the cold water results in cooling of large regions of the Earth. Not the entire Earth, because there will be regions in the northern continents which continue to warm, but around the oceans which receive the cold water. This cold water results in the abortion of the North Atlantic thermohaline, the North Atlantic thermohaline current, which is a current which keeps Northern Europe, Western Europe, and also Eastern United States and Canada, keeps them warmer than they would have been otherwise. The study also occurred right through the glacial-interglacial period, back to at least 800,000 years and much further than that. So we are now looking at a study. A large pool of cold water is recorded now south of Greenland, and also some cooling by meltwater in the, around the Antarctic, but that's less clear. So very few, at least in my readings of whether it's the media or even scientific papers, the important researchers are in Germany. It's Rumsfeld. I can send you the paper. He has made the observation of large, very large cool water ponds south of Greenland. That's a confident signature. Now, when this cooling happens, and the time frame is not known, not clear, it can happen very abruptly. So the collapse of the North Atlantic thermohaline can occur, has been occurring very abruptly in the past. There have been such events recorded. Now, if it happens, it can happen very fast. And, of course, the denialists will say, oh, look, there's global cooling. We were right. Yeah. And the problem was that the IPCC has kept on portraying gradual growth curves, trends, in global temperature, and has not taken this likely study into account. So this gradual trends, they have confused and, in fact, misled public politicians, economists, and so on, who think, we can arrest the warming at any point we like and bring it down. But the study, what it tells you is that the climate is not going to warm in any uniform way. The variability is going to increase. Up and down, up and down, up and down, but in the long term, up. It's complicated.
Well, as I read in your book, the climate has been pretty unstable for the last million years or so as ice ages come and go, and humans were formed during that time. And I wonder if we are biologically adapted to instability, maybe we depend on it, even though our civilization can't handle it.
Yes, you're right. I think so. I think some humans, and more likely those who are living in remote parts under extreme conditions, like the Inuits or in a relatively cool part of the Earth, they have been survivors on and off for periods, prehistorical periods. So as groups, tribes, clans, individuals, I think humans are great survivors. Civilization, of course, as you know, it depends on tenuous networks of communication, oil, and of course, trade and all the rest of it. And I cannot see, again, I hope I'm wrong, I cannot see civilization surviving 4 degrees. And 4 degrees is where we're going because of the amplifying feedback effects. It's not just the carbon dioxide which is rising. It's also, as it's rising, it results in fires, further melt, desiccation of vegetation, methane release, and all these amplifying feedback effects are increasing the warming, which it has been taken into account, but possibly not sufficiently.
That's wishful thinking, if ever I heard it.
I'm not against wishful thinking, not now.
Look, they pushed us too far. They didn't think we'd fight no matter what they did.
And they were wrong. We fought, we expunged them. We didn't do such a bad job on ourselves. With the interesting result that the background level of radiation in this very room is 9 times what it was a year ago. Don't you know that? 9 times. We're all doomed, you know. The whole silly, drunken, pathetic lot of us. Doomed by the air we're about to breathe. We haven't got a chance.
I won't have it, Julian. I won't. There is hope. There has to be hope. There's always hope. We just can't go on like this. We can't. We...
I shouldn't drink, you know.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Hi, I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Dr. Andrew Glickson from Australia. We're talking about his new book about the Pleistocene, and I'll give you links to all of that in my blog at ecoshock.org. And I notice, Andrew, in figures in your book, we can see unequivocally where the big carbon emissions come from. A map from the Oak Ridge National Lab shows the bright yellow and high red emissions from the eastern U.S. states, Europe, South Africa, India, China, Indonesia. We know who the great emitters are. Does that matter?
Well, the biggest one is China. Does it matter? Well, it's a global issue. So it comes from industrial centers, wherever they are. You're right, yes. But it also comes from the consequence, amplifying feedback effects, such as the melt of the Arctic sea ice and ice sheets in itself results in a greater degree of warming than all the carbon emissions combined. But it is an amplifying feedback effect, you see. We need to distinguish between the primary factor, primary reason, primary emissions, and between the secondary consequential ones. And the consequential ones can surpass the primary ones.
Do you think, from your studies, that our greenhouse gas loading of the atmosphere will delay the next ice age, or could it even end the whole pattern of recurring ice ages?
Well, yes, the ice age occurs mostly due to glacial terminations are triggered by increasing solar energy, solar radiation, which warms the ocean water, and so this warmer ocean water releases more carbon dioxide, and so once again, there is a primary factor, which is the solar radiation, but there are all the consequences. Yes, well, it's bound to. The Earth will be far too warm for the next ice age. It will delay it. There have been calculations and papers based on it. Again, I can send it to you, or they are cited in the book. A warmer Earth will delay, not forever, of course, because carbon dioxide does not exist in the atmosphere forever. So according to some papers, a delay in the next ice age will be on the order of 20 or 30 thousand years.
When I talked to Dr. Peter Ward, he said that rising seas, not heat, will have the greatest impact on humanity and all the species as the climate shifts. Are you in agreement with that?
Oh, it all depends whether we like to be boiled or fried or incinerated. I mean, really, it's a confluence of factors. High temperatures result in sea level rise. The reason that sea level rise is particularly potent is because civilization is anchored on coastal regions and low river valley regions. And they will be, once they're flooded with salt water, the centers of civilization and agriculture as well. Well, think about it. If you look at every delta in the world, where crops are grown and where hundreds and hundreds of millions of people live, they'll be inundated. Now, you can't say that one is more important than the other because they are intertwined. Sea level rise because temperatures rise. So I can't see that anyone can say that these consequences can be separated from each other. You can't dissect it. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
So, Andrew, you don't say all this because you saw a vision or due to a religious belief in the end times. You do present dense volumes of science to back up your projection, but I'm still going to call you a doomsayer. Is that fair?
This is a terrible term. That's what the denialists are telling us. I avoid this term like the plague. Wherever I can, I point to ways out. There is, in principle, a way out. I talked about it earlier. Humanity makes to decide to put the effort into life rather than into death. by, say, investing the military budget or military budget scale funds into drawdown of carbon dioxide, this will make a difference, in principle anyway. Doomsday, I refuse to be coined this way, because what I do is very much what medical doctors do. If they diagnose a patient which has initial signs of a tumor or cancer, they are not called doomsday doctors or people, because they also suggest ways of either minimizing it or delaying it or doing what's possible. That's precisely, I think, what climate scientists do. That's what I do. The doomsday, it's a curse, because I don't think in such religious terms like doomsday. I try and think purely in scientific evidence-based terms.
Most of my scientific guests feel required to say that this unpleasant future could happen unless we act strongly right now, but they've been saying that for about 11 years that I've been doing this. Do you feel an obligation to optimism? Is it in your book?
I haven't written much in this book about the drawdown, about mitigation of carbon dioxide. I haven't written much about it. I think I do mention it in the book. I've talked about it and written about it elsewhere. The book does not include everything, but particularly interesting, there are people who've done the calculations, and I will send you the link to James Hansen's recent interview and talks about this very subject. He and his colleagues have worked out the billions of dollars, let's say $600 billion, to draw down the amount of carbon dioxide that is being released or emitted in 1 year. And so this needs to be done, well, every year. If emission continue, it will stabilize the release of carbon dioxide. It must not stabilize the amplifying feedbacks. But I strongly recommend that you listen to that interview with him and with other scientists, because it's very recent. They have worked it out. They worked it out, well, in a quantitative or rather a semi-quantitative way. And this is, in principle, the way out. This is a choice which humanity needs to make.
Well, I'll put that link in my blog at ecoshock.org, and that's published on Wednesdays, so listeners, you can get it there. We have talked a lot about the science that you draw from, and almost every sentence has several annotations. But you also write poems, and you draw on art yourself. Do you need that? Do we need that?
Well, I need that, because to me, the poems express, well, the evidence and the facts reflect, represent reality to me. The poems represent, well, human, perhaps partly spiritual aspects which I have and which most of all people have. So to me, to combine it as preambles to certain chapters is very relevant. Or otherwise, the human scale will disappear from a book like that.
And I don't think any Glickson interview would be complete without at least a little bit from you on the subject of fire. I know that that's been something you've worked on a lot and thought about a lot. Do you want to just give us a little snapshot of what your thinking is?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. Well, that relates to the deep time origins of a human intellect, human mind, the human spirit, and the human destructiveness too, imagination destructiveness. It's a theory. It's almost impossible to prove. But the theory is that over the, well over a million years, that humans have spent the nights camping around campfires, just watching the flames, have affected their mind. Now, there is a reason why I'm saying it, because I myself, as a geologist, have been spending quite a number of years in the outback watching flames, sitting around it. Fire and watching the flames, which are, they appear alive. The fires, the flames appear alive, and they capture the imagination. On the basis partly of my own time around campfire, but also for other reasons, such as humans are the only organism that has captured and controlled fire. We don't know of any other animals which have. So to me, it's a plausible theory, but of course, as you know, in science, we need to prove things, and I don't know how to prove it.
It's kind of poetic the great map that's being drawn by science now of our past, something that you've worked on intensively, of the Earth's past, really, how the continents have moved around, how the ice has affected things, how the climate has changed. Why aren't we learning that in school? Why don't we talk about that in the media? Why don't people know where we came from?
Yes, that's a very important subject which needs to be told in school, and I agree. Another issue which needs to be taught in school is ethics and morality. You cannot grow young people just on the basis of information. The morality, the ethics of behavior between people, between groups of people, between nations, is something which, it's a key to our survival. And it's not being taught intensely, comprehensively enough in schools.
Have you had any feedback, either from the media or other scientists, about your new book, The Pleistocene? I mean, what do you expect?
I've learned, as a personal note, to hope for the best and expect nothing. This way, don't get disappointed. In the case of this particular book, it's a book which I wrote with a sense of trepidation, because I knew anyone who's going to look at it, read it, is going to be depressed by its contents. And I almost feel guilty. In fact, I had been in the book launch, which has been, by the way, recorded, and I can send you the link to the recording.
I'd like to hear that.
Yes, I will send it to you. I expressed some misgivings about the effect it will have on people. Now, as to publication, yeah, the book is being distributed by Springer. People are reading it. I get minimum feedback. I had from the reviewers, when I submit a book, I have to submit a number of reviews of the book. The reviews are published by Springer on the website somewhere. I think, once again, I don't know exactly where it's published, but I can find, look for the link. So some people just look at the introduction and the conclusion. Some people look at the pictures. I'd say relatively few people read it, too. So the truth is, no, I don't have much feedback. And we had no feedback from the open letter. You see, the message one gets, or which I get, is that it's not so much the denials which are the problem. It's a sense of helplessness and apathy on the part of all of us, including in universities, where only 10% of people that we invited to sign the letter have actually signed the letter. There is no huge risk in Australia for signing an open letter like this, which was very polite. And by the way, I don't know whether you've seen this letter, but I can send it to you. So why is it only 10% of scientists, people who are supposed to know better, that would sign a letter like that? I think it's something about the sense of powerlessness, apathy, and the great attraction of a life for the day in the present. Maybe that's the answer. People, tens and tens of thousands of people go to watch sports and go to casinos and all the rest of it, and not enough people, even those who are aware of the situation of danger, not enough of them are prepared to take a stand. I think it's something about the nature of collective groups of people, large populations, in terms of whether they would just go to a war, unjustified wars, or whether they just accept the ruling from the top. I don't know. This is the herd mentality of it. It's all things which you know anyway.
It's not easy. You know, we know about climate change, a few of us, and yet we still have to pay the bills. We have to live lives and talk to our children. So it's very tough. I feel like we're sort of sliding over the edge of a cliff and still trying to hang on to the TV shows that we really like as we go.
Exactly.
It's not easy. So James Lovelock, you know, like you, predicted we humans may survive as a few breeding pairs huddled around a tropical Arctic sea. And so he says, enjoy yourself. It's later than you think. And that sounds good, Andrew, but frankly, I haven't been able to find peace because I know that we are mucking up the future for our grandkids and for all of the species, who do count, by the way. This is such a beautiful place. Can we allow ourselves to have that peace, should we?
Yes, well, James, as you know, James Lovelock made a U-turn. He said a few years ago that he's sorry, but he was wrong in his books and so on. Well, I can see it as the confession of an old man who doesn't want to, didn't want to worry and cause depression to other people. I see it as that. I don't think it changes. The science and evidence did not change. And James Lovelock, of course, is an intelligent, brilliant individual. He would know the evidence did not change, but he regretted that he has caused, well, sorrow, sadness, depression to many people. That's the way which I understand it. And enjoy the day. Yes, this is right. Life, I feel, the way I feel now, knowing what happened and what can happen, is life is for the day, like the butterfly. Life is for the day. And without focusing too much on the past and the future, even though we do, that's the way I try to live my life, but I have to admit I'm not very successful.
Me either. But you know, earlier I mentioned the possibility that human survivors may not know if a nuclear war happened or what happened. And in the same way, you and I, as aging humans, we have to admit, we may never know if the dark future we fear or see developing really happens. I think we will pass out of this world still in a mystery. Would you agree with that?
Well, we look at trends. We look at the basic laws of physics and trends. The basic law of physics means includes the black body radiation effect, the greenhouse effect. As the greenhouse gas rise, temperature rise, we have full, absolute, totally incontrovertible evidence for that. As to the nuclear, well, we know what nuclear can do. So I don't know how to avoid these scenarios and how to avoid these trends. And to say that this might not happen, this would be a spiritual, a personal, humane spiritual statement, but I don't know that it is based on evidence which I'm aware of.
Is there anything else that you would like to talk to us about as we wrap up here?
Well, I could add a few personal notes, although I already have. I mean, I have, in a way, so deeply dismayed by the very weak response of even my fellow scientists, the reticence of expressing the full reality and consequences of what we're looking at, that it puts a distance between you and between people who either don't know or don't care. Those who don't know, I can understand. But those who know or don't care, I cannot understand. It's a difference between, I don't know, being a fully conscious human being in between people who basically don't care. And if you care and other people or another person doesn't care, it puts a distance between you and them. And I think that people in the medical profession, for example, once again, develops this kind of sentiment. And some scientists develop this sentiment, but I try not to express it just now that you ask me. There are major consequences to being a medical doctor and being in climate science. For example, you don't want to talk about it too much with your family. They will not wish to. They will eventually run away from you if you keep on talking about the end. And so we have to conduct a very, very careful balancing act of if and when appropriate, talk about the evidence, about the reality of it, but not talk about it too much or in terms of our future or children's future, because this belongs to the unthinkable and it's beyond human power. So I, well, like many others, I find myself just having to conduct this balancing.
But it's horrible, Andrew, because, you know, if Hitler's armies were marching into our streets and we could see that, and some people say, well, that's too depressing to think about, let's not talk about it, you'd still have to call out, well, the armies are coming. And in this case, it's global warming that's coming and nuclear Armageddon that's coming, possibly. We can't keep quiet.
Well, Alex, it's the frog in the warming and boiling water. As you know, people in horrible situations, even in concentration camps, in Auschwitz, there were those people who had what they call an optimistic gene. They somehow always had hope, maintained hope, and sometimes they survived better thanks to this optimistic gene. But then there were those people who just despaired, gave up, and died. That's an extreme example, but a much more widespread example are in all the wars. Well, my parents lived to World War II, my grandparents lived to World War I, and were caught in it. My grandfather was a doctor in the Russian army in World War I, and he has saved a life by amputation of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. These people lived through periods which we, fortunately, people who were born well either during or immediately after World War II, we lived in a bubble. We lived in a period of open-ended growth in terms of standard of living, and for us in the West, relative peace, although we kept on bombing and killing people in remote parts of the world. But we lived in this bubble, and I don't know how long this bubble can continue. So we have a somewhat different outlook on life than people who were caught up in this major catastrophes, in wars and in concentration camps. I think that these are my thoughts about our condition.
We have been talking with Dr. Andrew Glickson. He's currently a visiting fellow at Australian National University, where he has a long and distinguished career. His newest book is more like an in-depth course, I think, in the big picture future generated by the amazing science going on all over the world. And here in this book, we have a marriage of nuclear disaster and climate change, both going on together. It's called The Plutocene, Blueprints for a Post-Anthropocene Greenhouse Earth. It's published by Springer. Find links to all of that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew Glickson, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
No, thank you very much, Alex. You're doing a very important job with this program of yours.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. As the Australian media has chosen not to talk about or republish the letter sent by 200 scientists from Australia to the Prime Minister, well, Radio EcoShock is a tiny little speck of Australian media because we are broadcast by a couple of radio stations in that country. So here we go. I'm going to give it a shot. This isn't easy, but I'm going to try and read out the letter sent by those 200 scientists in the hope that somehow it will wiggle its way around through the media and perhaps even reach the Australian public and the Prime Minister. To the Right Honourable Malcolm Turnbull MP, Prime Minister of Australia, there is no Planet B. Dear Prime Minister, March 2016 temperatures soared to the warmest in the instrumental record, with mean global temperatures of plus 1.28 degrees C above the 1951 to 1980 baseline, following a succession of peak annual global land-sea temperatures of plus 0.42 C in 2000 to plus 0.87 C in 2015. Developments in the atmosphere-ocean system reported by major climate organizations and in Australia, the CSIRO and BOM, include a rise of atmospheric CO2 level to 404.39 parts per million, July 2016, at a rate of 3.08 parts per million per year, a rate unprecedented in the geological record since 55 million years ago, tracking toward the stability threshold of the Antarctic ice sheet, estimated variously at 450 plus or minus 50 parts per million CO2. The rise in greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere and oceans is leading to an increase in extreme weather events relative to 1950-1960, including tropical storms such as those in Fiji, Vanuatu, and the Philippines, with lives lost and damages estimated in the billions of dollars. In Australia, the frequency of extreme weather events has been rising, where since 2001, the number of extreme heat records has outnumbered extreme cool records by almost 3-1 for daytime maximum temperatures and almost 5-1 and more for nighttime minimum temperatures. Impacts on a similar scale are taking place in the ocean, where CO2 rise is causing an increase in acidity from pH 8.2 to 8.1 already, predicted to decrease further to 7.8 by 2100, affecting coral reefs and the marine food chain. Ice sheet melt rates and sea level rise have been increasing, and the rate of sea level rise has been accelerating from about 1.7 millimeters a year over the last century to 3.2 millimeters a year between 1993 and 2010, and to 3.9 millimeters a year, threatening low-lying islands, delta, and lower river valleys where billions of people live, compounded by changes to river flow regimes. We are concerned global warming, amplified by feedbacks from polar ice melt, methane release from permafrost, and extensive fires, may become irreversible, including a possible collapse of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. According to Professor James Hansen, NASA's former chief climate scientist, burning all fossil fuels would create a different planet than the one that humanity knows. According to Professor Joachim Schellenhuber, Germany's chief climate scientist, we're simply talking about the very life support system of this planet. We note that, in agreement you stated in 2010, we are, as humans, conducting a massive science experiment with this planet. It's the only planet we've got. We know that the consequences of unchecked global warming would be catastrophic. We, as a human species, have a deep and abiding obligation to this planet and to the generations that will come after us. End quote. From Malcolm Turnbull. While the Paris Accord remains unbinding and global warming has received minimal attention in the recent elections, governments worldwide are presiding over a large-scale demise of the planetary ecosystems, which threatens to leave large parts of the Earth uninhabitable. We call on the Australian government to tackle the root causes of an unfolding climate tragedy and do what is required to protect future generations and nature, including meaningful reductions of Australia's peak carbon emissions and coal exports, while there is still time. There is no Planet B. And that letter was signed by 200 Australian scientists and presented and sent to the Prime Minister of Australia, no answer yet, and given to the media, and no interest from the media. Hey, it's only our life support system on the table. No sense talking about that. But we will talk about it here on Radio EcoShock, and I certainly appreciate you listening to this show each week. Please join me again. I'm Alex Smith.